Welcome to a love story, but a love story with a twist. A boy named Jacob, he leaves home to start a life and to find a wife. His journey leads him to a Middle Eastern watering hole near Haran, where he meets this gorgeous young shepherdess named Rachel. Verse 17 in Genesis 29 refers to Rachel as beautiful of form and appearance. In other words, both her face and her figure were attractive. She was a cover girl working as a shepherd. She was stunningly beautiful. I guess you could call her a fox in sheep's clothing. The stone that covered the opening of the well was huge and heavy, and the shepherds usually waited on each other's arrival to water their flocks, since it required a combined effort to move the stone. But on that day, when Rachel arrived, verse 10 tells us that Jacob flexed his pecs and he moved the stone all by himself. Nothing like a little macho demonstration of some muscle to try and impress a girl, but apparently it worked. We're told in verse 11, then Jacob kissed Rachel. I've heard it said, a boy becomes a man when he discovers it's more fun to steal a kiss than second base. Well, apparently a young Jacob is growing up. He plants a kiss on a ravishing Rachel, and we're told in verse 11, Jacob lifted up his voice and wept. Now, I read recently about a woman over in Alabama whose pet iguana stopped breathing. She had to give the slimy reptile mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And afterwards, she cried because she realized that she had kissed the iguana. Well, trust me, that's not why Jacob's crying. His tears are tears of joy. He thinks he's found the gal of his dreams. But beginning in verse 16 is where the plot thickens. For Rachel takes her new boyfriend home to meet dad, and Jacob should have been warned. A young man fresh from mama's house was no match for a shrewd dude like Laban. Listen to what we're told in verse 16. Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. And here is the twist in our love story. In Haran, as in parts of the Middle East to this very day, it was contrary to custom for the younger daughter to marry before her elder sister. Thus, Leah was a roadblock in Jacob's plans to marry Rachel. And to make matters worse, the prospects of Leah marrying anytime soon seemed slim because she had an awful problem. We're told in verse 17, Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now this phrase, Leah's eyes were delicate, it can mean one of two things. First, it can refer to the health of Leah's eyes, that they were weak, squinted, perhaps even cross-eyed. Rachel had these deep, beautiful pools of blue, these mesmerizing eyes, while her sister Leah had these little slits above her cheeks, awful-looking eyes. But the phrase, Leah's eyes were delicate, can also be interpreted, Leah was a cause for sore eyes. In other words, the poor girl was so ugly, she made your eyes hurt when you looked at her. Either way, Rachel's sister Leah was not a very physically attractive young lady. There is actually a college in the town of Ugly, England. A spokeswoman for the institute was recently quoted as saying, "We try to call ourselves the Women's Institute of Ugly, but the name never sticks." And I'm sure the women of the school are no doubt glad. But let me tell you, old Leah, she could have graduated magna cum laude from the Women's Institute of Ugly. Rachel was a sight for sore eyes, whereas Leah, she made your eyes sore. Well, when Laban offered Jacob a job and told him to set his own wages, Jacob makes an interesting request. Verse 18 reads, "Now Jacob loved Rachel, so he said, 'I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter.'" The length of time no doubt showed the depth of Jacob's love for Rachel and probably how long he thought it would take for Leah to marry first. Verse 19. And Laban said, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. How beautiful is that? His love for Rachel just made the time fly by. I believe the willingness to wait is always a characteristic of genuine love. Well, the story moves ahead 7 years. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her." And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now, an Oriental marriage feast lasted a whole week. And so for 7 days, the groom and his buddies, they partied hardy. This means that by the time the wedding night rolled around, Jacob was probably pretty sauced. He was tanked. Verse 23 informs us, "Now it came to pass in the evening that he," that is Laban, "took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to Jacob. And Jacob went into her." In addition to Jacob being inebriated, the brides in those days wore these heavy veils and these long flowing robes. And since there were no electric lights in the honeymoon cottage, Jacob assumed that he was going to bed with his beloved Rachel. He was consummating his marriage with Rachel. Verse 25 fast forwards about 8 hours. "So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah." And it's hard to read that line with the same sense of disappointment Jacob had to have felt. He had been stabbed in the back. You talk about betrayal. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me?" Again, Jake kisses a girl and starts to weep. But this time for a very different reason. He has kissed the iguana. He has spent the night with old lizard lips Leah. In verse 26, Laban stuns Jacob with his answer. "It must not be done so in our country to take the younger before the firstborn." Now, what an ironic twist of fate. For if you're familiar with your Old Testament, you'll recall that before leaving home, Jacob had stolen the rights of the firstborn from his older brother Esau. Jacob had spit in the eye of custom, and now custom was spitting back. Jacob, the deceiver, gets deceived. What goes around comes around. That's why honesty is always the best policy. Now, this Laban, he's a sly guy. He's a crafty bargainer himself. And so he makes Jacob an offer of his own. He says, "Fulfill her week, and we will give you this one," that is Rachel, "for the service which you will serve with me still another 7 years." Laban agrees to give Rachel to Jacob now, but in return, he's going to have to serve another 7 years. And Jacob buys it. He agrees. Verse 30 tells us, "Then Jacob also went into Rachel, and he loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years." Never doubt Jacob's initial love for Rachel. He serves a total of 14 years for Rachel. But the question arises, what should Jacob have actually done after he woke up next to Leah? And it's my opinion that Jacob should have never married Rachel. You see, nowhere in the Bible does God approve of bigamy. A man was never meant to have multiple wives. In Matthew chapter 19, our Lord Jesus himself lays out God's ideal for marriage. "Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh?' So then they are no longer two, but one flesh." God's blueprint for marriage was one man and one woman in a lifetime relationship. God tolerated bigamy, much as he tolerates divorce today. But realize, he never gave it his stamp of approval. In fact, Jesus himself condemned bigamy. You remember the verse, Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, there we're told, no man can serve two masters. God never intended for a man to be married to two women. Recently, a Middle Eastern archaeologist, he uncovered this cuneiform tablet. The translators, they went to work deciphering what the ancient letters meant. And they discovered that the tablet was entitled, "The Top 10 Reasons No Man in His Right Mind Would Want Two Wives." And I happen to have with me tonight the ancient Semitic Chaldean, the translation, you know. So here it is. Number 10, twice as many birthdays and anniversaries to remember. Number 9, you have to pick who gets a second garage door opener. Number 8, by the time two wives take a shower, there's no more hot water. Number 7, who can afford 24 roses on Valentine's Day? Number 6, when it's time to choose, it's now 2-1. This is my favorite. Number 5, your one drawer and half a foot of closet space gets cut in half. Number 4, two wives would be frowned on at the Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain marriage dinner. Number 3, 2 honey-do lists. Number 2, 2 mother-in-laws. And the number 1 reason no man in his right mind would want 2 wives, PMS twice a month. Apparently, Jacob never read this top 10 list, for if he had, he would have added one more reason why 2 wives are not a good idea. They might not get along. Read ahead. Jacob's family becomes this sordid example of infighting and envy and ugliness and bitterness and hatred and deception and manipulation. Later, when Rachel names one of her maid sons, she calls him Naphtali, which means my wrestling. And she says, with great wrestlings, I have wrestled with my sister. Hey, Jacob lived and his kids were raised in the middle of 2 warring women. This was not a happy home. I believe that Jacob should have never married Rachel. He should have just left with Leah and learned to be content. Of course, I can hear somebody say, come on, Sandy. The girl was ugly as mud. And he didn't even love her. Why are you saying he should have left with Leah? Or left with Leah. Hear ye, hear ye. I believe that even if Jacob didn't love her, if the two of them had conducted their marriage God's way, Jacob would have eventually loved Leah every bit as much as he initially loved Rachel. For love grows when marriage is done God's way. You know, it sounds funny saying it, but the feeling of love is a far overrated ingredient when it comes to success in marriage. Oh, it's important in courtship, but in marriage, it's way overblown. Successful marriages are built on commitment and sacrifice and devotion, not simply feelings. I've seen marriages where the love was depleted, but the husband and wife decided to stick it out, do things God's way, and love started to grow again. On the other hand, I've seen marriages abounding in loving feelings, but the couple ignored God's wisdom and the feelings dwindled as the marriage broke apart. You know, if you wanted to plant a garden and you had the best seed available, yet you buried that seed in sorry, scorched, dry, superficial soil, I don't care how good the seed would be, it would fail to germinate in that sorry soil. Yet if I had inferior seed, but I had fertile, nutritious, moist dirt, even the sick seed would grow in the healthy soil. And so it is in marriage. Give me 2 people who can't stand each other and encourage that couple to interact God's way, and love will grow out of nowhere. I've seen it happen. And men, as the God-ordained leader in your home, why don't you be the first to renew your commitment? In his letter to his daughter, Pastor Charlie Shedd, he passes on some important advice. He says this, marriage is not so much finding the right person as it is being the right person. And let me repeat that. That's worth the price of admission. Marriage is not so much finding the right person as it is being the right person. You see, the dating game emphasizes finding the right person and relying on chemistry to cement the marriage. But when the chemistry eventually dries up, we blame our former Mr. or Mrs. Right. He or she must not have been the right one after all. We remind ourselves there are other fish in the sea. We throw back our current spouse and we rebait our hook. Some of us keep kissing frogs thinking we'll finally find our prince or our princess. It never dawns on some people that the problem just might be them. I honestly believe that you can take a man and a woman who have never seen each other but are determined to do marriage God's way. The man willing to love his wife as Christ loves the church. The woman willing to follow her husband as the church is to follow Christ. Each of them caring and serving and showing compassion and giving each other time and sharing their hearts and living their lives for each other. You put those two people together and they'll end up happily married. Actually, this is what happened to Jacob and Leah. As we're told in verse 30, in the beginning, he loved Rachel more than Leah. But there's strong evidence that slowly, over time, Jacob's initial feelings changed. We're told later in the chapter, when the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. So Leah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Reuben, for she said, "The Lord has surely looked on my affliction. Now, therefore, my husband will love me." And at first, your heart just breaks for Leah. She's always longing for Jacob's love. But notice what happens next. Then she conceived again and bore a son, and said, "Because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also." And she called his name Simeon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, "Now this time my husband will become attached to me because I have borne him three sons." Therefore his name was called Levi. Obviously, old Leah kept laboring to make her marriage better. All that's mentioned here of her efforts are her three labors, but I'm sure she labored in other ways to improve her plight as well. So that finally, in verse 35, we're told, "And she conceived again and bore a son and said, 'Now I will praise the Lord.' Therefore she called his name Judah." Then she stopped bearing. Judah means praise. The implication is that all her effort had paid off. And with the birth of Judah, she praises God. Finally, her desires have been fulfilled. At last she experiences the enjoyment and the security of marital love and no longer feels the need to bear another child. When you jump ahead to the end of Jacob's life, you find him making an interesting choice. In Genesis 49, he's on his deathbed, and with his last breath, he makes a final dying request. He cries out, "Bury me in the cave where they buried Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, and where I buried Leah." You would have thought that Jacob would want his final resting place to be next to Rachel in Bethlehem. But oh no, he asked to be buried in Mamre alongside Leah. Oh, on the first night of their marriage, Jacob resented lying next to Leah. But at the end of their road together, it was his utmost desire. Jacob wanted to make sure that until the day of resurrection, his bones would lie next to Leah's. Apparently, his heart had turned. You know, it's ironic, but Rachel died prior to Leah. Thus, Leah was the wife who ended up with Jacob all to herself. It was Jake and Leah who enjoyed growing old together. It's also interesting that it was through Leah, not Rachel, that Judah was born. The Messiah came through the tribe of Judah. Thus, Jesus was of the lineage of Leah, not Rachel. Perhaps that was God's way of putting his stamp of approval on the union between Jacob and Leah. Their offspring became the link in the royal line. You see, in the beginning, we're told Jacob loved Rachel more than Leah. But in the end, the roles reversed. Old lizard lips Leah became Jacob's beloved. On that awful morning, when Jacob awoke to discover that he was lying next to Leah, that he had been double-crossed, he didn't seek an annulment. He realized that with God, there are no accidents, that God is sovereign, that nothing happens that he does not at the very least allow. Jake accepted his wife, and he built a life with Leah. Perhaps you've always felt that your marriage was somewhat of a double cross. She was pregnant, and you felt it was your duty. Or her home life had soured, and your good job made for a convenient escape. Your marriage was expected. You both were pressured. You were way too young. You weren't seeking God at the time. Hey, you need to realize, just as Jacob did, that none of that matters. That marriage is sacred. Vows are binding. In God's plan, once you say, I do, you did. In his sovereignty, God allowed the two of you to marry. Trust me, the Almighty could have stopped it. The pastor could have come down with laryngitis right before the vows. A lightning bolt could have struck the building and burned it to the ground before you walked down the aisle. But God chose to let it happen. The deed is now done, and now it's up to you to accept your marriage as God's will and make the best of it. You remember that old song from the 70s? I think it was written by Stephen Stills. If you can't be with the one you love, honey, love the one you're with. Well, that's biblical. It's sort of biblical. But I tell you what is biblical. If you really love the one you're with the way God wants you to love them, you won't desire anyone else. You might be stuck with a Leah, but if you let him, God will turn your Leah into a lover. Years ago, before teaching this passage for the first time, I prayed, Lord, what a sordid mess. Deception and bigamy and constant infighting. What a terrible marriage. How can I possibly apply this sour marriage to the good marriages at Calvary Chapel? And I believe the Lord gave me a figurative application that speaks to us today. I know it goes a bit beyond the context here, but it's not unbiblical in what it teaches. Here it is. I believe that like Jacob, every married person in this room tonight is, in a sense, married to two people. If you're a man, you're married to a Leah and to a Rachel. And if you're a woman, you're married to both a Lee and a Ray. Now hear me out. Every married person here tonight is wedded to a Rachel. This is the part of your spouse that you love, that you're attracted to, that you adore. This is the person who fires your engines. You could be forced to wait on this Rachel for 7 long years, and your love for her would cause it to seem but a few days. But you're also married to a Leah. And this is the part of your spouse that was a surprise. When you married your mate, you knew you were getting Rachel, but you didn't know about this Leah. Lee is the ornery, ugly, selfish side of your husband. Leah is the side of your wife that was covered up and veiled and hidden before the vows were taken. Yes, you are also hitched to a Leah. In every marriage, there are mornings like the day after Jacob's wedding night when you roll over, you look into the eyes of your spouse hoping to see Rachel, but instead you start to cry. Oh no, it's Leah. I have kissed the iguana. Hey, you need to come to terms with the truth. There is a Leah and a Rachel side by side in every spouse. It's been noted in rural Japan, a man's wife is chosen by his parents, and he doesn't know who she is until after the wedding. Though the custom in America is completely different, the end result is the same. It's true. I don't care how long you date a person before you marry them, whether it's 7 months or 7 years or 17 years, you never learn all there is to know about your spouse. Believe me, there will be some definite surprises after the wedding day. There are aspects of your spouse that resemble Leah. Hey, the blemishes were there from the beginning. Nothing's really changed. But you were drunk on love, and you didn't see them. Your spouse is not what you thought, and it becomes a shock when you realize it. And so the question becomes, what do you do with a Leah? What do you do with a Lee? Well, the first morning Jacob saw her, he complained to Laban. But what did he do the next morning? And the morning after that? Or the morning after he left Laban's house? Here's what Jacob does. Let me read you again verse 31. When the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, he opened her womb, but Rachel was barren. Jacob began to see that the fruitfulness in his life was coming from Leah, not Rachel. That the offspring, the growth, the fruit, the life was being supplied by Leah. Yeah, for a while, Rachel was still his choice for a good time. I mean, at first, she was certainly the wife he took to the company Christmas party to make a good impression. But over time, Jacob realized that God's blessing was more on Leah than on the trophy wife. God was using Leah more than Rachel to grow Jacob and to grow his family. Surprisingly, spiritual life and fruitfulness came more from old sore eyes than from the cover girl. And here's the application to our lives and to our marriages. It's often the rough edges, the ugly traits, the ornery attitudes in our spouse that cause us to grow and mature spiritually. Oh, when I'm loving and sensitive and all compassionate, I console, I encourage my wife, I minister to her. But when I test her patience and push her kindness and tax her endurance and stretch her faith, I force her to trust in the Lord, and Jesus ministers to her. You could put it like this. When Sandy's on his best behavior, he causes Kathy to glow. But when Sandy's less than his best, he causes Kathy to grow. Fruitfulness flowed into Jacob's life through ugly Leah rather than through gorgeous Rachel. And the fruit of God's Spirit will flow into our lives when our spouse's blemishes force us to draw upon the Lord. When my wife looks to me and I cause sore eyes, I force her to look to Jesus and she gets blessed. And don't misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that there are no limits to our acceptance of a spouse's behavior. For example, I don't believe that any married person should stand out idly by and bear with a promiscuous or an abusive spouse. I mean, these aren't the traits that Leah represents. When a person tolerates a cheating or a beating, they become an accomplice to the crime. You become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Now, here's what I'm saying. I'm simply suggesting that you learn to accept your spouse's humanness. Leah couldn't help her ugliness. And I'm sure the poor girl tried with all this. She tried to be the best she could be. She styled her hair and applied lots of makeup and bought lots and lots of heavy veils and all. And likewise, all married folks should try to be the best that we can be. But the real breakthrough in this relationship came when Jacob learned to accept his wife unconditionally. Hey, we all should want to please our spouse and glorify God, but we need to face the fact that no matter how hard we try, none of us are ever going to be perfect. Leah turned out to be a diamond in the rough, but Jacob didn't see or appreciate her beauty until he gave up trying to change her and accepted his situation. It is a wise man, a wise woman, who stops trying to change their Leah or their Lee. I heard someone say, the only time a woman succeeds in changing a man is when he's a baby. Or women marry men expecting to change them while men marry women thinking they'll never change, and you know, both get disappointed. Husband, wife, listen to me. Husbands and wives, it is not for you to change your spouse. Your job is to love your spouse. God will change your spouse if he or she needs to be changed. Heard a wonderful story of a wife whose husband bought her a brand new car. She was maneuvering in the mall parking lot when she had an accident, and it was all her fault. She worried about her husband's reaction. When the police arrived, they asked to see her proof of insurance, and so she opened up the glove box and she pulled out a insurance card, but along with it, there was a little envelope. She opened it up and she found a note. As she read it, it made her cry. The policeman asked her what was wrong. All she could do was just hand him the note through her tears. It was from her husband and it read, "Honey, in case of an accident, remember it's you I love, not the car." Here's a husband who decided in advance to simply love his Leah. And this is how you turn a Leah into a lover. You accept him or her for better or worse. You love your spouse for who they are, warts and all, sore eyes or not. Once a hillbilly wife commented on her wedding vows, she told her friends, "Then their vows say for better or worse, because he ain't gonna get no better and he sure can't get no worse, so I take him as is." Hey, Leah was probably as ugly the day Jake buried her as the day he married her. But along the way, Jacob learned to accept her as is. And this is what each of us needs to do for the Leah in our spouse. Unconditional acceptance is the miracle cure. It frees up the Leah in a person from the pressure and the insecurity of never measuring up. And trust me, we're always better and more lovable when we know we can be ourselves and still be accepted. And it also frees up the Jacob in us from allowing impossible expectations to hang a constant cloud of failure and discouragement over our marriage. The Jake in all of us needs to stop mourning over what ain't and what can't and start enjoying what is. We get so fixated on the 10% negative in our spouse, we forget the 90% positive. All the things we loved about them in the first place. We forget that Leah and Rachel live side by side in the same person. On her 50th wedding anniversary, a wife shared the secret to her long, happy marriage. She said, "On my wedding day, I decided to make a list of 10 of my husband's faults, which for the sake of our marriage, I would overlook." Well, a guest asked, "Which 10 faults did you list?" She shrugged and said, "Well, to tell you the truth, I never got around to listing them. But whenever my husband did something that made me hopping mad, I'd just say to myself, lucky for him, that's one of the 10. Forgiveness and mercy and patience, kindness and acceptance and gentleness and compassion. Hey, that's all stuff that we as Christians are supposed to be good at. And these are also the ingredients that transform a Leah into a lover. Each one of us wants and expects our mate to accept the Lee in us. But this evening, I'm challenging you. Why don't you ask God to help you accept the Leah in her? Husband, don't you think it's time that you give your wife a break? She does the best she can. Those kids are so demanding. Her job is never over. She needs your time and your attention. And wife, don't you think you ought to cut that old boy some slack? I mean, he's come a long way, and he carries a lot of responsibility. He really loves you and those kids, and he wants to be a godly man. Hey, support him, even when he doesn't do all that you'd like for him to. You see, each married person has a choice. We can focus on the thorns on the rose, or we can focus on the rose among the thorns. Our cup is either half empty or half full. It's up to us. This Valentine's Day, if you want a fruitful marriage, why don't you decide to simply love your Leah? Father, I thank you for your word to us tonight.